How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.
Hello, you're listening to DNA Today, a genetics podcast and radio show. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. I'm also a certified genetic counselor practicing in the prenatal space. On this show, we explore genetics' impact on our health through conversations with leaders in genetics, experts like fellow genetic counselors, researchers, doctors, and patient advocates. This episode is a double episode, if you noticed, and we're recapping the National Society of Genetic Counselors' 40th annual conference this year. We're going to be highlighting a few presentations by catching up with a couple of the speakers. There was so much enlightening content, and I highly recommend checking out the conference if you haven't already. Most sessions are available on demand if you missed the live presentation, so certainly recommend checking that out. Because of the virtual platform, there's just so much content that is still available, I believe, till the end of November. If you're a healthcare provider helping pregnant patients, you have inevitably been asked the question, can I take this medication during my pregnancy? Then you need TERRAS, a clinical electronic resource that contains information on the teratogenic risk of over 1,700 medications and other environmental exposures and infections. This includes 200 of the most frequently prescribed drugs. What makes TERRAS a unique database? TERRAS is governed by an advisory board of world-renowned experts in clinical teratology and is an intellectual property of the University of Washington. Visit TERRAS today via the link in the show notes, also available at dnapodcast.com, and use code DNATODAY for your free, no-obligation, two-week evaluation license. Do you or someone you know have Prader-Willi syndrome? Harmony Bioscience is looking for people with Prader-Willi syndrome to enroll in a new clinical study in the United States. Harmony Biosciences will be studying the safety and impact of an investigational medicine on excessive daytime sleepiness, cognition, and behavioral function in people with Prader-Willi syndrome. Use the link in the show notes to learn more about the clinical study and refer a patient to a study center. The link is also available at dnapodcast.com. Joining me now is Laura Hersher. She's the director of research at Sarah Lawrence College and a fellow genetics podcast host of The Beagle Has Landed. In NSGC this year, she was part of the presentation called Advocating for Autonomy, Genetic Counselors as Champions for Comprehensive Reproductive Health. Thank you so much for joining the show, Laura.
Thanks for having me, Kira.
I thought we could start out with an overview of Texas SB 8, as this is very timely, and providing listeners an overview of how this limits abortions.
Oh, yeah, it's a distressing situation. I mean, from my point of view, SB 8 is so badly put together that wherever you stood on abortion, you might very well be opposed to this particular law because the framework within it operates is so sort of counterproductive to good healthcare. So the way it works is that anybody that suspects that an abortion happens after 6 weeks, which is just 2 weeks after your last missed period, so it's really, really early, often prior to anyone even being aware that they're pregnant, and certainly prior, for instance, to any minor's ability to get services in, since they need permission and so on. So it's just an incredibly early point in time where less than, I think, 10% of all abortions occur. So anything after that is now illegal under SB 8. And the way the law works, the penalties, is that it allows anybody who has a notion that this happened to sue anyone involved with the abortion except the person actually getting the abortion.
That's an interesting acceptation. Like, you know, you can...
Well, it's often the case that they go after other people, and I think that there's a number of reasons why. Number one is that, generally speaking, public relations-wise, people react very badly to abortion laws that penalize the individual involved. That creates a lot of sympathy because you're going after sort of people in desperate situations. But more importantly here, I think it's more effective to penalize the providers. This case, the law could also... I mean, people talk about it being applicable to a cab driver who dropped you at the facility or a friend that held your hand and listened to you and said, sure, you should go ahead and get an abortion. So literally, it seems hard to know how you would get at that particular relationship, but anybody that provides you any advice or sympathy, but it's a lot easier if you're talking about it's your genetic counselor, right, who sort of advised you. So it creates this, and $10,000, that's what someone can recover through these lawsuits, is up to $10,000.
So it's incentivizing people to rat people out of saying, oh, I heard that this person was getting an abortion and this is the like Uber or Lyft driver that brought them there, or this is the doctor that they were having perform the procedure. Like all the people that were involved in it are liable.
Right. So instead of putting it on the penalty on the desperate woman who, or any other individual who's pregnant, who might be, you know, one time in their life seeking an abortion, right? It penalizes providers so that it makes it difficult to be involved with abortion. So you could theoretically, as a genetic counselor, go through your day advising people throughout the week who need termination as a part of reproductive care or who want a termination. You know, it could be facing dozens of these lawsuits. So it makes it absolutely impossible, right? Like differently than going after the person for that one time. If you see what I mean? It sort of disincentivizes anyone from being involved with anything to do with abortion. And that disincentivizing is, of course, the whole idea. Shut the whole thing down. In addition, it really lowers the bar. So this is like a fact to give you an idea of the mindset of the people that wrote this law. If somebody sues, they says there was an abortion, they take this person to court, they take the cab driver to court, they get the counselor to court, they hit the person who did the abortion, whoever it was, they take to court. If the lawsuit succeeds, the person can recover up to $10,000 plus their court costs, plus the costs. If they lose, if it's frivolous, if there's no reason for this lawsuit, if say it was an abortion and they turned out able to prove that it happened before there was any heartbeat, which is actually the way this law is phrased, so it's early, the person who's now been sued in this frivolous lawsuit has no recompense. They have to show up, they have to defend themselves, but they can't recover for any court costs. So the way the law is structured is to lower the barrier for entry to create these lawsuits, but make it very difficult to defend yourself even when they're crap. So it's a very much a loaded situation intended to make anything to do with the practice of abortion in Texas virtually impossible.
And this brings up the point of disproportionately affecting people in Texas that come from different socioeconomic backgrounds, because some people may be able to easily cover these legal fees and other people that might be a huge barrier. And just thinking about Texas is a huge state. So people that can just fly or drive to another state could get an abortion and then come back. But people that can't afford to do that, they're in a really tough position where they can't access an abortion.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about this a lot during the EBS that you referenced in the beginning. And this is true of every restriction on abortion, which is they appear geographically on the map. You can see, like, here's the states where you can't get abortion or where it's difficult to get an abortion. But this is a matter of class and social standing and not geography. Because anybody that has the wherewithal, and it's complicated, it's not simply about money, right? Yes, you need the sophistication to make the arrangements, to know how to make them. You need to be able to pay for a trip, an airplane, whatever it is it takes. You need to have the social supports around you. Let's say many people who have an abortion, they already have children. Who's going to watch their kids? It means you need to have people that you trust and and willing for this purpose to drive you to the airport, watch your kids, whatever it is you need. You need to feel safe in taking a few days off from work. It's a whole big picture. And the really frustrating thing about these restrictions on abortion, and this is one set, but there's obviously much, much more to come, much, much more in place, much, much more to come, is that they fall only on certain populations and disproportionately on the most vulnerable segments of our population. And so we are going to be saying to one group of people, you guys no longer have control over your reproductive health. You will have babies when you get pregnant. You will have to have them and raise them. And other segments can opt out of that. They can distance themselves from that. And in our field, I think that's incredibly important, because now you're talking about, you're going to have children who might have this medical problem or that medical problem, and whole other segments of the population can distance themselves from that. And it, I think it brings up an incredibly damaging dynamic where you might have people saying, like, well, why should we be supporting these people who I don't relate to and are from another group? And it can't happen to me, you know. All of a sudden, help and support for those members of society that either have genetic disabilities or genetic diseases and conditions, or have them in their family, they're going to be begging for pure sympathy, because the people are not going to, in the mindset that they might have today, which is there but for the grace of God go I.
And yeah. I think that's
a good point. Big picture problem.
Yeah, especially with, you know, we're both genetic counselors. I'm a prenatal genetic counselor. So this is something that I'm constantly processing with patients if a result comes back a high risk for, especially like a fatal genetic condition. And I want to remind people that this, in Texas, this ban is at 6 weeks. Many people don't even know they're pregnant 6 weeks or just finding out. And genetic testing, the earliest you can do genetic testing through blood work is nine weeks. Usually 9 weeks is like the earliest. So that's 3 weeks beyond the ban. How is this affecting genetic counselors in Texas? Because that's where this is occurring. I mean, that to me, I would have to completely approach my job and the way I talk to patients differently. I don't know if I could even offer some of this testing if termination is an option that the patient might pursue with a high risk or a diagnosis of a genetic condition.
I've spoken to some genetic counselors who do prenatal work in Texas, and really striking to me, they're unwilling to come and speak publicly about it themselves, because the very mention of the word abortion in public, they felt like right now is an invitation to frivolous lawsuits, as crazy as that sounds. But yeah, they were talking about needing to, from absolutely the very first step. I mean, even if you're talking about carrier screening, you have to say to somebody, how are you going to use this? Because if you can't use it in the pre-implantation form, and that's very expensive and not open to a lot of people, then is it worth spending hundreds of dollars doing this testing when there's not a damn thing you can do about it, because by the time you can test for it in the state you're in, it's illegal to do anything about it. So for people to make a truly informed decision about even carrier screening, counselors have to be aware of the impact that the law is going to have on their patients and talk to them about what their options are, including the ability to go out of state. So right then you're setting up that drawing a line between your patients right there. You start dividing them into people for whom this is useful and people for whom this isn't useful. And I think it's very telling of how damaging this all is if you think that right away you're saying, I mean, here we are saying like carrier screening, this great innovation, it's working so well, it's of value to so many people. And you're like, yeah, but not you. Not you. You know, that's disturbing. Most of this I find disturbing, and not so much because, I have this sympathy for somebody who simply believes that abortion is wrong. I mean, I'm not unsympathetic to that point of view personally. I think there's a lot of room in the world to have that discussion, but it always seems to be coming up in this incredibly disingenuous and misleading way where it's abortion available for some people, but not for other people. And I'm afraid it's going to end up being prenatal testing available for some people, but not other people. And that kind of two-track universe is a scary place, I think.
And a lot of people are, you know, nervous and apprehensive about this is happening in Texas right now, but could this have a national impact in the future? I mean, how could the Supreme Court affect this? I saw, you know, during your presentation, I think another presenter mentioned a case, Jackson Women's Health Organization versus Dobbs. Is this, you know, having involved with the Supreme Court? Like, what is the status of like a national impact after this?
Yeah. Well, you kind of put two things together, but the Supreme Court is hearing a case that directly challenges Roe v. Wade and Casey. They're going to hear it this year, and with the decision expected next year. Many people anticipate that this may be when the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade altogether, in which case all of the states that now have reason bans will also simply ban abortion. Now, it's possible that they'll do something sort of halfway so that they don't get rid of Roe v. Wade, but simply expand the exceptions or the ways in which we're allowed, the caveats, let's say, to Roe v. Wade. So they'll give states many more options for restricting abortion while nominally keeping Roe v. Wade in place. But either way, whatever happens, whatever it's called in the legal record, the fact of the matter is the Supreme Court would not have accepted that case if they didn't plan to fundamentally change the abortion laws as we see it, because it's such a direct challenge, right? It's sort of Roe v. Wade and Casey say, you can't make the restrictions that Mississippi made. And Mississippi openly in the memo that they write to support their case said, we think what you should do with this is overturn Roe. So there's not a lot of wiggle room in there. And they decided to hear it. So the assumption is that states are going to have a lot more latitude to restrict abortion coming up. And in a sense, it means that these reason bans are less important because, well, if all abortion is illegal, does it matter that this abortion is illegal? It puts people in the same position. But I would argue that as genetic counselors, we ought to be hyper aware of the fact that from those people who brought you anti-abortion legislation across the country, they are also now thinking about prenatal testing. And their feeling is prenatal testing, when you find something, document something that might be wrong with the fetus, that leads to abortion and it doesn't lead to anything else. And therefore, there's a case to be made against having or funding prenatal testing across the board. And that's going to be a battle that we're going to have to fight no matter what happens with the abortion law.
Yeah, I think that's a good point in that, you know, I see in my daily practice that prenatal testing does not always lead to an abortion. And I think as you highlighted, that's really a misconception that's highlighted with these laws. And you mentioned a couple times reason bans. Can you define what this is and how it could directly affect genetic counseling?
Sure. A reason ban is a ban on an abortion that would otherwise be legal, that is made illegal based on the motivation of the individual seeking the abortion. So it's not always about genetics. Reason bans have been passed that say abortion is illegal if the reason for the abortion is that the person is unhappy with the sex of the fetus or the race of the fetus. But I think what's very much germane to genetic counseling practice, and it's also the most common of these, is laws that state this abortion is not legal if the reason why the individual is seeking it is either the diagnosis or the suspicion of a genetic condition in the fetus. Now, that's sometimes called a suspicion of Down syndrome specifically, and sometimes called genetic anomaly, genetic conditions. There's a whole range of the way it could be talked about. I think they often stick the word Down syndrome in there because there's a sort of a sympathy reaction to that, where a lot of people will say like, oh, I'm not against people with Down syndrome. Right. You know, that's right. They shouldn't. Whereas if you said developmental disability, people actually on polls are more likely to say like, oh, you know, that's an abortion. I would like to have that option, you know? So it's a little bit of gamesmanship, what words they use. It changes the legal standard. Sometimes they say sole reason. Sometimes they say sole or part. Well, that's really hard to argue against because how do you say it wasn't a part of the reason? Anyway, you can see that they're the big picture issue here that I'd like to point out is that they've gotten more draconian from the very first, which was in North Dakota, to the recent, which was in Arizona. The recent one in Arizona is a felony. You can do jail time, loss of license for doing these abortions. And sorry, this makes me crazy. I had to pause and pull myself together to say it. In Arizona, the law includes an extra stipulation that anybody, and it's best special mentions counselors specifically, anybody who knows that such an abortion is being planned and doesn't turn the person in can be sued for up to, can be given fines of up to $10,000.
And that could be a lot of people, a lot of healthcare providers. You're not just talking about the genetic counselor provided the news. You're talking about the doctor that works with them, the person that drew the blood that maybe gave the results over the phone. I mean, there's so many people.
But think about what that really does. What it sets up is it says, as the patient, you not only cannot get this abortion in your home state, you can't talk to your medical provider about it because they might end up liable for $10,000. So that they're going to shut that down. So more that this is the kind of thing that more than anything else, who does that disadvantage? The person, we all know the difference between our patients. Picture the patient who is not in a position to put this together themselves. Maybe she's 14 years old. Maybe she has cognitive issues. Maybe they have mental health problems. Whoever it is, maybe they don't have access to internet. This entire system means the person who's savvy enough to arrange this outside of their home medical system and go get it is unfazed by this law. But it comes down hard on an individual who needs our help. And it also creates, I mean, just against all precepts of medical ethics, it creates a situation where a person is told you cannot trust in and confide in your medical provider, and it encourages them to be not truthful about what they say to medical providers, which as medical people, we know how dangerous that is.
Yeah, we need to know what the patient is thinking, feeling, be able to answer their questions. I mean, that's what genetic counseling is, educating and processing this information and how that's going to affect their decision making. So that's basically preventing genetic counseling at the heart of what genetic counseling is.
Right. Anything that cuts directly at your ability to establish trust with your patient means you're going to do a less good job for them across the board.
And before we end, I wanted to pick your brain about how public opinion has changed over the last years, decades. I mean, is there a correlation between that and so many more laws for abortion coming up? And I think in 2020, there's been like astronomical number compared to other years. I'm remembering from another, I think before your presentation.
Yes, yes. Andy, who gave a presentation as a part of that EBS, it was terrific. He did a great job.
I took so many notes.
He mentioned that I believe it was 90 is the most laws that were ever passed restricting abortion in a single year in the States was 90. And in 2021, we've had 90 just in the first 6 months. So there's this incredible jump, and 90 is a huge number. So what's happened in the last 20 years is the number of restrictions on abortions have gone through the roof, mostly centered in a number of states, but a lot of states, if you look at it, it's across a lot of area, and you look at the Guttmacher maps that show states hostile to abortion, it's a pretty substantial swath of the map. And remember that while that may not be where all the people live. So like, it's like the electoral map can be very misleading. But if you're a person there and all the states around you are hostile to abortion, those miles are for real. So the distance you have to travel to get to somewhere that isn't unfriendly to abortion gets bigger and bigger as the states pass these laws. And the amazing thing is all this has happened with remarkably little change in public opinion on abortion.
I was shocked when this was covered because I was thinking, well, if more laws are happening, that's because public opinion's changing, who we're voting into office, like all that downstream effect. But it's like hasn't changed.
No, maybe I'm not a scholar in this area, but maybe you could make an argument that the people who are against abortion have gotten more passionate, louder,
that's a good
more
point.
Fixed, less flexible, less sort of, but the fact of the matter is there was a poll out this morning said 65% of this country opposes overturning Roe v. Wade. 65%, a solid majority of this country is in favor of keeping Roe v. Wade. And that is a bigger number than 65% is in favor of having abortion, at least in certain circumstances. And often that includes diagnosis of a medical problem in the fetus. So it's not being driven by public opinion as regards what percentage of the public supports or doesn't support it. It is in the sense being driven by public opinion in the sense of that this is a existential issue for a minority of voters, that the anti-abortion voice in this country is very intense with the fervor they bring to the issue. So I guess maybe that says that the segment of the population who feels really strongly about having abortion available to people as a part of their routine medical care has to be very intense as well.
Yeah, definitely surprising to, you know, learn certain aspects of this. And I really appreciate you coming on the show and explaining this to the audience, because I mean, this is so timely right now. And I'm just so glad that you guys were able to cover this as part of the NSGC conference. And on your show, The Beagle Has Landed, you have an episode that's, I think, almost an hour about abortion law with your guest, Jordan Brown. So people that want to hear more from Laura Hersher about this topic, be sure to check out her podcast, The Beagle Has Landed. Thank you so much, Laura, for coming on the show and sharing all of this insight. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. I feel like I'm back at Sarah Lawrence, you know, covering all the news and everything. So.
Kira is my student, and it's really great to catch up with you and keep doing the great, great work that you do.
If you have patients with Prader-Willi syndrome, please let them know about a new clinical study looking for participants across the United States. Harmony Biosciences will be studying the safety and impact of an investigational medicine. The study will focus on excessive daytime sleepiness, cognition, and behavioral function in people with Prader-Willi syndrome. The study participation is 4 months long and consists of 5 visits. If you're a patient, at your visits, you will participate in sleep tests and have general check-ins on how you're feeling. You'll also need to keep a sleep diary for the first 2 weeks and a closing diary once you start treatment. If you're a caregiver, you'll attend all visits with the patient and help provide information to the trial researchers. There are 13 trial sites in the United States, and Harmony Biosciences will reimburse patients to travel to their closest site. Refer yourself, a patient, or a loved one to the study by visiting the link in the show notes, which is also available at dnapodcast.com. Are you a healthcare provider for pregnant people? How do you look up if a medication is safe during a pregnancy? TARIS, the Teratogen Information System, is your answer. It's a dynamic clinical teratology database that contains expert information on the teratogenic risks of a variety of pregnancy exposures. TARIS is available as your go-to resource for over 1,700 pregnancy exposures, including 200 of the most frequently prescribed drugs. Each drug has a summary based on a thorough review of the published clinical and experimental literature. TARIS goes beyond drugs and includes many environmental exposures like viral infections. TARIS is an academic resource housed at the University of Washington and governed by an advisory board of global authorities in clinical teratology from the fields of medicine, epidemiology, and genetics. Each agent summary includes a teratogenic risk rating that is derived by a consensus from the TARIS advisory board, so you know you're getting the most accurate information for your patients. TARIS offers yearly subscriptions, and since you're a DNA Today listener, TARIS is offering you a free, no-obligation 2-week trial. Use code DNA Today with the link in the show notes, also available at dnapodcast.com. Joining me now is Sally Rodriguez. She was one of the presenters during NSGC's presentation called The Devil is in the Details, Race-Based Medicine and Healthcare Disparities in Genetic Counseling. Sally Rodriguez is a genetic counselor at Sequence 46, which is a PGT laboratory. Thank you so much for joining the show, Sally.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah, you had such an interesting presentation, and we're going to be talking about your portion, which focused on carrier screening. So one of the main aspects that you were focused on was race ethnicity-based testing versus pan-ethnic testing. For those that may not be familiar, can you just go over the basic of like what the difference and like the purposes behind those two types of carrier screening?
Yeah, of course. So race or ethnicity-based testing in carrier screening specifically refers to offering race or ethnicity specific panels. So for example, if a patient is Black or African American, offering them a panel with a certain number of conditions versus if the patient is Ashkenazi Jewish, offering them a different panel of conditions. A pan-ethnic approach means that you would have a standard panel that you would offer to all of your patients regardless of their self-reported race or ethnicity.
And you bring up an interesting concept of self-reported race ethnicity. And as genetic counselors, this is something that most people are asking their patients during session, maybe during the family history session of, you know, I phrase it to patients like, oh, what countries are your ancestors from, to start that conversation. But there can be an issue with self-reported race ethnicity. What is the problem when we're using data from what patients are sharing?
Yeah, so it's a complicated topic because I think, you know, we all identify with whatever our specific ancestry is, right? So my family is Dominican. I am of Dominican, you know, descent. And so I know, for example, that individuals who are Dominican are an admixture of, you know, Europeans because of the colonizers, Africans due to the enslaved individuals that were brought, as well as native or indigenous ancestry, the Taínos that were there in the very beginning. And so I identify as Dominican, I identify as Latinx, but what does that mean in terms of genetic ancestry? It could mean lots of things. We don't know what that split is. And so with self-reported race or ethnicity, those are, you know, how we identify ourselves, but it doesn't necessarily equal genetic ancestry or isn't necessarily a reliable indicator. And it can mean very different things depending on the particular individual and their level of admixture. And so that's where, you know, part of the problem comes in. And then of course there are individuals who simply may not know their genetic ancestry, right? There could be individuals who are maybe adopted and don't know that information. Or there's a situation of labels and how confusing those can be. So a lab form might say, okay, asking a patient to identify as, are they South Asian, Southeast Asian, or East Asian? And if the form doesn't include examples for those categories, a patient might select the wrong one, not quite being sure which one is the right one. And in general, across the world, we see lots of admixture. So there's a lot of reasons why self-reported race or ethnicity is sort of, you know, fine in how we use it in everyday life. But it's not necessarily a reliable indicator of genetic ancestry, which is what really matters for carrier screening.
Yeah, I think that's a good point in saying that, you know, each of them have a place. And when it comes to doing genetic screening and testing, we're really focused on that genetic ancestry and that term and looking at, okay, genetically, where are your ancestors from? And one of the reasons we're looking for this is because we are calculating residual risk based on oftentimes genetic ancestry. So to define residual risk, if someone does carrier screening and their partner comes up as a carrier for condition A, they are not identified as a carrier of that condition, which means there's a low risk of the pregnancy. But to give them a specific number of what's the chance the test missed that second partner is actually a carrier of a condition, they missed it, that would be the residual risk. And, you know, as a prenatal genetic counselor, I'm looking at this and I'm telling patients, okay, we didn't see that you're a carrier of this condition, but this is the chance that the test missed that. When it comes to calculating residual risk, I mean, should we continue using the self-reported race if it's not reliable for that genetic ancestry?
Good question. So right now we have to, right? We don't have great alternatives, honestly. There was actually a talk earlier this morning by Semaphore about their new test, and this is not an endorsement of them specifically. I'm not employed by them or anything, but they have a new panel where they're including or incorporating genetic ancestry. And I'm curious to see how that will pan out, because I think that could theoretically be the future of carrier screening, where ancestry is incorporated and you can get more personalized residual risk assessments based on that. But for now, with a majority of labs not offering that kind of analysis, we have to some extent use self-reported race or ethnicity. And that's okay. I think what we need to be really clear on with patients is that what we give them is an estimate. We have to get away from these like hard and fast fractions and these numbers that we think, you know, are written in stone, because that's just not reality. That's not the world we live in. And I think patients respond to that level of slight uncertainty better than we would expect. But giving them an estimate is really the goal. And maybe even focusing on the detection rate piece a little bit more. So if the lab report indicates that the detection rate is particularly low in a specific race or ethnicity due to usually maybe like a high rate of the U.S. in that particular population, that's something worth mentioning, right? So you say, well, you know, your starting potential, you know, carrier risk was this. We know the detection rate is about this much. So we know your risk is reduced to about this much. This is an estimate. And at the end of the day, most of these residual risks end up being well below 1%. And so I think it's more about giving patients context on what they can expect out of this testing, but the understanding the limitation that like there's no such thing as a test that tests for everything and gives you a 0% residual risk.
Yeah, I think as genetic counselors, we're constantly saying, you know, people say, oh, I want all the testing and I want to cover everything. And you're like, well, I wish there was a test that would do that, but we can't offer that at this time.
Yeah.
And I think you highlight an important concept with this residual risk estimates, that it is an estimate. So we're talking about statistics here. This is not an exact number. And as you said, for most people, if both partners are not identified as a carrier for the same condition, that reproductive risk, that the pregnancy will be affected by one of these conditions, is less than 1%. So I think that's important too, to put things, you know, into perspective in terms of like, well, what is this risk that we're talking about? We're not talking about 50%, 75%. We're talking about less than 1%. And with residual risk estimates, as we've kind of been hinting at, there is a disparity between people of different genetic ancestry and what that risk estimate is and how specific it can get. During the presentation, you had a quote that just really stood out to me. I like went back and I was like, I really want to get this quote exactly. And, you know, you said, if you have patients of different races who have the same insurance plan, same premium, they will ultimately get different levels of care, which I thought was really impactful, because you just put it so plainly that there is this disparity there. But where does this disparity stem from? Like, why is it there?
Mm-hmm. So it's funny, because I think we're moving in the right direction, just from a technology perspective, and closing those disparities a little. So it was sort of at its worst when carrier screening was really for a select, you know, number of mutations for a select, you know, few diseases. So for example, that CF panel of like 25-ish, 30 mutations, which, by the way, there are OBs that still order that panel, and it blows my mind. Blows my mind. And that panel, I mean, it's hugely problematic, right? If you have two patients, one who is Ashkenazi Jewish and one who is, let's say, East Asian, getting that exact same panel of mutations, yeah, they have different a priori carrier risks, but they also have vastly different detection rates on that particular panel of a few mutations. And so their residual risks are ultimately very different. And you're giving them a different level of care. You've decided, not, and I don't mean a specific genetic counselor, but, you know, the society that created this list of mutations decided that was okay. That disparity was okay. And I think we need to get away from that. And we have gotten away from that. Now, most carrier screening, really all carrier screening, except for the docs who are still ordering those limited panels, is happening via sequencing, which is a really good, great step in the right direction, right? No more of just a few mutations that happen to have been studied in specific populations. And so that already helps to close some gaps. But of course, we have the other side of the coin, which is that sequencing means more VUS. And in the prenatal space, VUS don't get reported, for good reason, because you're just opening up a massive can of worms if you're trying to report out a bunch of VUS in individuals who are pregnant, or who are in sort of a time crunch situation where how are you going to decide what to do with a pregnancy. But my hope is that VUS rates will decrease over time as we continue to get more data, right? As we get more patients who are non-white involved in research and we get more data, we can start to discern these VUS and say, okay, this is, based on all this evidence, more likely to be pathogenic versus more likely to be benign. And as we reduce that pool of VUS, we can really start to affect those disparities. But right now, that's just going to take time.
And when it comes to VUSs, it would be crazy, I think, at this time to give VUSs for every single patient. I mean, our whole day would be filled with VUSs. You know, as a prenatal counselor, I'm like, I can't handle that unless I have a second genetic counselor only handling VUSs. But I mean, I can see it possibly being important if partner A comes back as a carrier for a condition, we're testing partner B, and we're like, okay, we didn't identify them any pathogenic variants. So it's like, okay, we have this for sure mutation, they're a carrier of this condition. But in those cases, should we, you know, identify the VUS and share that? Like, should the lab report that? Because we have a higher risk in general for the pregnancy because one person's a carrier. I don't know if this is something you've thought about in terms of if this is something that we should be telling patients and explaining to patients, or if it's just we're too far off from that right now?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. It is something I've thought a lot about. And I think it's something that there's room for, at least in these updated guidelines and the guidelines that it's in general, sort of talk about the fact that VUS can be requested on sort of case by case basis. I agree that getting a report full of VUS, but it's a nightmare that no one needs.
And it's not going to help the patient really at that
point. It's not going to help the patient. It's really just, it's too much. But yes, if you have a couple where one individual is a carrier for condition A and the partner is negative for condition A, but perhaps when looking at the lab report, the detection rate is listed as low, and we might guess that that's due to a VUS issue, that might be a situation where, let's find out if there were any VUS for this patient on this gene, because maybe that's something that we need to consider. Of course, how you manage it once you get the result, like let's say you ask the lab, and the lab doesn't have any VUS for the patient in that particular case, great, okay, you feel reassured. But if they do, what do you do next, right? Are you going to be offering amnio? And things start to get a little bit more complex there. And I think that becomes a counseling conversation, right? I think patients have a pretty good sense of what they are willing to tolerate in terms of risk. Most people do. And so for some patients, it may be something where, yes, I would really like to do prenatal testing, and others it's not. Of course, then you get into the problem of which prenatal testing lab is going to do testing for VUS, because
that's
I don't
point.
Think that that's routine. So there's several cans of worms here. But I do think that it's fair to consider requesting VUS information in those kinds of situations. And I can even think of a real life scenario that was discussed in a presentation yesterday by LabCorp of a couple who the female partner was a carrier for autosomal recessive polycystic kidney disease. Male partner was negative on carrier screening. They were then pregnant, and then they started to see abnormalities on ultrasound related to the kidneys. And so additional testing was ordered in that gene for the partner, and the second lab came back with what was considered a likely pathogenic, well, I guess was upgraded to a likely pathogenic mutation, but the original lab had called it a VUS, right? So that's why it wasn't on the original report. So, you know, the VUSs can matter, can affect things. And so I do think on a case-by-case basis, it's fair to request it, particularly if you've got ultrasound anomalies or other reasons for why it might be good and useful information.
Yeah, and that was a really interesting presentation. They just went through like three case presentations. So mm-hmm. all the talks that we're mentioning, all the sessions, we're going to put those in the show notes so you guys can go directly to them if you're, you know, a member of NSGC or part of the conference. The other part that I think about with looking at variants is if labs are using ancestry, either self-reported genetic ancestry, if they're using that to figure out these variants, SMA is one that, you know, is they're taking that into consideration for like that residual risk. Mm-hmm. But I mean, are labs using that at all explicitly for variant interpretation, or is it really only for residual risk?
So I think, for example, for the SMA piece, right, the silent carrier piece, it's used specifically to identify that haplotype and then, you know, present that adjusted residual carrier risk, because in certain populations that haplotype is more common. The silent carrier haplotype is more common. So that's I think sort of separate from the concept of will or how are variants and polymorphisms being used otherwise. So I think, for example, like this new Semaphore offering, it sounds to me, again, I haven't like dug into their stuff, but from this morning's presentation, it sounds like they're using SNPs essentially, right, to do a genetic ancestry assessment. And then based off that, let's say the patient comes back, you know, 50% European, 50% African, for the sake of picking something straightforward, then they can calculate a personalized residual carrier risk, or maybe even residual reproductive risk if it's, you know, both partners got tested, using like weighting based on those ancestries, their results and the detection rates in the different ancestries. So it's like, you know, a calculation essentially. So that's, I think, an interesting way to do it. I think there are always ways to improve that. You know, I from looking at their presentation this morning, there were some things that I had more questions about, and I'll definitely be pinging them on those. But I think it's a good way to get into trying to be a little bit more of a personalized medicine approach to some extent for carrier screening, and making it a little bit easier to calculate what those residual risks might be. But again, reemphasizing to patients that, you know, all of these are estimates to some extent. And the personalized risk assessments will be better estimates, right? A little bit more personalized estimates, but estimates nonetheless. No one, you know, needs to go to the bank with a very specific fraction and think it's the end all be all.
Yeah. And I think, as you said earlier, too, that this could be the future of carrier screening, and including looking at, what was it, like, I don't know, a lot of SNPs they looked at. I don't want to give a number because I'm going to get it wrong. But
it was a lot. It was a lot. Yeah.
It was a lot of SNPs. So single nucleotide polymorphisms. So I can see that in the future being like, oh, that's just part of carrier screening. So it's always exciting to hear something where you're like, oh, this could be the next big thing in carrier screening.
Yeah.
The other big part of this, you know, we're both practicing in the U.S. and so insurance is a whole battle for us. and practice guidelines can often influence insurance. And so you mentioned a few months ago, ACMG updated their practice guidelines for carrier screening. What were the major updates when it comes to this race-based carrier screening that we've been talking about?
Yes. So they just came out with that this summer. It was a very exciting moment for me. I've been shouting this from the rooftops for years. Finally saying out loud what I think a lot of us have known for a long time. Race or ethnicity-based carrier screening is not only like scientifically flawed because of all the things we talked about with race and ethnicity being essentially social constructs, or as we heard in the Roll Nick lecture this morning, invented political category. I think that actually really gets it across really clearly. It's not just scientifically flawed, but also, you know, inequitable. And so that it's just not okay. We need to be offering the same panel to everybody. What that panel size is, well, they had a recommendation on that. There's been some controversy on that piece, but the big piece from the race and ethnicity end was, let's offer the same test to everybody. I think that's a really great step in the right direction. But we do need additional society guidelines. Again, like ACOG needs to come out with something, because at the end of the day, OBs are the folks that order the most carrier screening.
Yeah, I can definitely agree with that. For OBs that are referring to my office that I'm meeting with their patients, and I'm like, okay, the panel they had is much smaller than I order. And then I'm covering that with patients, and it's like, okay, well, why did my doctor order this then? Why didn't they offer what you're doing? And you know, I think that's just an issue in so many levels. And, you know, along with that, of just having these practice guidelines, like, all be updated with it. And I think that there was someone in the chat, I don't know if it was during the hallway session you guys had or during the actual session, could have been Scott Weissman. I don't remember exactly. I know he was part of the conversation, but talking about that there can be reasons, like indications, to do the carrier screening. So if I'm sitting with a couple that both have Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry, I will talk about that and say, you know, you do have a higher chance of being a carrier for a condition. And sometimes they say, oh, well, now that I know that, I want to do the carrier screening. I'm still ordering the same thing I do for every patient, but that may lead them to do carrier screening as opposed to not doing it. I mean, it's always a decision. But I think that's an important concept, that what we're ordering shouldn't be different, but maybe the reason for doing it is different based on ethnicity.
Yeah, no, and I think that's fair. It makes sense, right? We do know that there are more conditions with founder mutations or common mutations in certain races or ethnicities, right? So for example, if I had a Black or African American patient, I would say, yes, you have a higher risk of being a carrier for sickle cell than a patient who is, you know, at least self-reported Northern European. Of course, like that's science, that's math, that's probability. And so I think, you know, it's fair to ask a patient about their, you know, race or ethnicity. The question is, are you ordering different tests? And we really should not be doing that unless there's basically no way around it. So if the insurance will only, you know, cover testing for the three Ashkenazi Jewish mutations for BRCA1 and 2 in a cancer setting, well, that might be where you have to start with that patient. If they have to go the insurance route and they're not able to pay the out-of-pocket cost for a more comprehensive test, as an example. But we need to be pushing payers to update those guidelines, because some of those guidelines are wholly problematic.
And they're just outdated. Like at the time when this was first, you know, the first pathogenic variants, mutations that we figured out for in the BRCA genes, like, all right, that's what we know about. That's what we can test for. But we're so beyond that at this point. And it's like these practice guidelines can be just so outdated as opposed to what we're doing and ordering as genetic counselors. And as you said, there's a lot of other healthcare providers ordering genetic testing that are not certified genetic counselors. So it's like, it's catching up with all the other folks that are ordering genetic testing and saying, okay, we want to make sure that they understand, like, what is that standard that we should be ordering?
Exactly.
And you know, during your presentation, you also covered other downstream effects of disparity in carrier screening. We've been talking a lot about, like, during the pregnancy. You know, for a lot of people, they're doing carrier screening during pregnancy. You know, I always recommend, if you know and can, to do it before you're conceiving. But what are some of the other downstream effects of these disparities in carrier screening?
So, I mean, I think, you know, the obvious ones, right? If we're ordering different panels on different patients, it means that we could miss carrier status, we could miss carrier couples. And so we prevent that couple from having an opportunity to think about, would they want to, you know, do prenatal testing? Might they make different decisions? And sometimes finding out earlier can mean, you know, different postnatal care, right? So a couple may choose during pregnancy, they find out they're high, you know, have a high risk for having an affected pregnancy. And it's for a particular condition that maybe isn't covered on newborn screening, as an example. But if they know that there's that risk, that that baby can be tested right away, and we can determine whether or not that child needs treatment. And that can really, you know, it can have a real effect if we're offering different panels to different patients. So I use the example of cystic fibrosis in my talk, because I think it's one that everyone is really familiar with. We all learn about CF. We all, you know, regardless of what specialty we're in, everyone sort of knows the basics there. But the reality is that because historically we have offered different, you know, level of care essentially to non-white individuals, it means that we see disparities in health outcomes for non-white individuals who have CF. So they are more likely to carry mutations that are not common, that weren't covered on those, you know, 25 mutation panels, which means they're older at the time of diagnosis, they're more likely to have failure to thrive, they're less likely to be represented in clinical research, which means they're less likely to actually get to benefit from clinical research, which means now with the newest CF medications, which are amazing, they don't get those benefits, so they really have worse outcomes. And so these early decisions, you know, folks say, oh, this is just about, you know, you might miss a carrier status here and there. What's the big deal? Actually, it can be a really big deal if you look at what that leads to downstream. So it really matters that we think about these things at, you know, the inception, essentially.
And so many of these conditions, the reason they're on carrier screening is because they're serious conditions, you know, for the most part. And as you said, earlier identification and diagnosis leads to earlier treatment and can really affect a child's life and just like how those symptoms are going to be and just how serious the symptoms are going to be based on that. And that's why a lot of these conditions are also on newborn screening, but usually newborn screening isn't as extensive as carrier screening, at least of the expanded carrier screening. But I think that's a really good point of, you know, sometimes we get stuck in thinking, okay, carrier screening, we're just thinking about like risk to pregnancy, but obviously we need to look at the bigger picture there. And for the genetic counselors and other healthcare providers that do genetic counseling, for those that are listening, what are your recommendations on how they can individually help to solve these issues that we've identified?
Yes. So I think in the care screening space, certainly, we need to be ordering a pan-ethnic panel, period. No more offering, you know, just the patients who say they're Ashkenazi Jewish, the Ashkenazi Jewish diseases. You know, and I get that insurance is a big problem, and there are ways to work around that, quite honestly. But we need to be just offering a single panel to all patients. What goes on that panel is always up for debate. And that's a longer discussion, but we need to be offering pan-ethnic panels. We need to talk to the OBs that we work with and the MFMs that we work with, et cetera, and get them to understand that they need to be offering a pan-ethnic panel. And please, just no more 25 mutation CF panels. I just can't take it anymore.
And I feel like labs shouldn't even offer it. Maybe that's bold of me to say, but like, can we just not offer that anymore? Like,
I agree. We need to be phased out like yesterday. I think it's painful for me. But yes, we should be offering a sequencing-based test and the same exact panel to all patients. So that's what we can do as individual, you know, genetic counselors and healthcare providers. And then I think we need to put pressure on societies to issue updated guidelines like ACOG and NSGC, SMFM. And in turn, we need to be putting pressure on insurance payers. They have got to update these super antiquated policies that only cover, you know, XYZ for certain people on certain policies, because we end up creating so many disparities by doing that. You know, depending on what kind of insurance you have. And even just looking at Medicaid, that's a whole different beast. So there's a lot of little pieces that all have to come together, but certainly on like a, what can you do tomorrow? No more ethnic race or ethnic specific panels, no more 25 mutation panels, please.
And honestly, that's kind of easier too, to just be like, oh, we're ordering the same panel for anyone that's electing to do carrier screening. Isn't that just easier? And not only is it better for the patient, it's easier for the provider. So it's a win-win.
Yeah, 100%. I agree. No more asking patients and then picking a panel. I mean, I once worked in a lab where we had a clinic that offered different panels by race. And they had like, they had a, you know, a South Asian panel and an East Asian panel and an Ashkenazi Jewish, all these panels. And so they had a couple where one partner was Ashkenazi Jewish and the other one was, I think she was like South Asian. And they offered the South Asian patient the Ashkenazi Jewish panel and the Ashkenazi Jewish partner the South Asian panel, because in their mind, well, if that's how they, you know, and I was like, oh no.
Yeah, like, let's not do it that way. And then it's like, if they're getting different panels, they're not being tested for the same conditions, that just like opens up so many issues.
Like, so many problems. I was like, no. So yeah, just one panel, all of your patients.
Yes. And it's like single stream recycling. Let's just do everything in one.
Exactly. There are ways to work around the insurance piece a lot of the times. I know sometimes you can't. And we got to, and then that means we have to figure out how to put pressure on that piece. But as much as possible, the same panel for everybody.
Yeah. No, I think that's very, very good advice and simple. Because I feel like sometimes advice for things are like, oh, we got to do this and this and this. And this is just like same thing for everybody, same panel. But thank you so much, Sally, for coming on and just explaining all of this and, you know, sharing your thoughts on not only your own session, but, you know, we threw in the LabCorp case presentations, the SEMA4 genetic ancestry with carrier screening. So again, we'll have those links in the show notes. And I just really want to thank you for your wealth of knowledge on carrier screening. And the conference, as we were kind of saying before we started recording here, so many of the sessions have been really complementing each other and, you know, covering some of the same details and, you know, really just being able to complement each other in that way. So we definitely recommend checking out those. I think the Janice lecture has been one of my favorites so far.
You know, Janice lecture was great. Barbara's just fantastic. Yeah. The Rolnick lecture that we just watched, really great. I mean, just a really great MSGC meeting, I have to say.
Yeah, it is. It's been fantastic. And, you know, thank you again for coming on the show during the conference. It's kind of a crazy time. So really appreciate it and looking forward to, you know, enjoying the rest of the conference.
Of course. Yes. Thanks again for having me. And it was great talking with you. And if anyone, you know, ever wants to chat, I can talk about carrier screening until I die. So.
And if you want to connect with Sally on Twitter, she's at srod0587, or 0587, I should say.
Yes.
So, yeah, definitely connect on there, DC Chat, NSGC21, all of that stuff. So thanks again for coming on the show. To learn more about the show, you can head over to dnapodcast.com. We're also going to have the sessions that we've mentioned throughout the interviews in there. So you can check out which sessions those are. And if you want to connect with us on social, search DNA Today on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, and connect with us there. Any questions for myself, Laura, Sally, feel free to email in info@dnapodcast.com. And I would really, really appreciate if you could take a moment of your time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. That is how we are finding new listeners and educating more people about genetics. Next episode will be released this Friday. That's right, this is just a bonus episode. So our next episode is this Friday and explores the genetics of ALS with Genomenon. Thank you for listening and join us next time to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.